Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on August the 14th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland Francis King Carey School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
Well, hello, Frank. We've got a special today, our first TWiL special, and it's a back-to-school special. So we've asked our colleagues in health law, both in academia and even in practice, what are the new developments or sort of underrepresented issues that should be added to our health law classes this fall? What are the must-teach things that just aren't in the casebooks yet?
Yes, it's great to be hosting a back-to-school special because I think all of us, as we're preparing classes or just looking over the healthcare landscape for the next year, we're seeing many new developments on many different fronts, and it's terrific to get a panel of experts. Some are past show guests, some folks just folks that we've admired for some time, and hope to get on the show at some point, to get them all together to give their beads on various developments within healthcare over the past year or so. And we're focusing particularly on things that are just really important to being a good health lawyer, but that may be too new to be in casebooks or to be in printed materials yet. So to open us up, this part of the segment, Nick, what is your issue? What do you think is a case that folks really need to be aware of that came down relatively recently?
Well, I've got a really nice soft option as I get to go first. I'm going to choose North Carolina Board of Dental Examiners against the FTC. And I don't think I'm the only one that would rank this pretty high up. If you recall, Frank, when we had Bill Sage on the program back on episode 12, this is before we got some of the other big health law cases of the year. But even then, Bill was hailing the dental examiner's case as maybe the most important case of the year, with Armstrong exception and against exceptional child center maybe come second. So I urge listeners to go back to episode 12 to hear Bill's great insights into the case. Most of you will remember that this all started with a fracas in North Carolina, because the dental board, which was dominated by dentists, apparently were upset by, or their constituents were upset by, the number of non-dentists who were eating their lunch by offering teeth whitening services. So the board sent cease and desist letters to those non-dentists. The Federal Trade Commission filed an administrative complaint. It said that the board's concerted action to exclude non-dentists from the market for teeth whitening services in North Carolina constituted an anti-competitive and unfair method of competition. The board, all the way through the litigation, Fourth Circuit, and then up to the Supreme Court, argued that its members were invested by North Carolina with the power of the state, and that as a result, the board's actions were cloaked with antitrust state immunity under the Parker and Brown case. As Bill noted back when we discussed this case before, the Supreme Court's decision was not exactly nuanced. It was short and it was blunt. The majority holding that when a controlling number of the decision makers on a state licensing board are active participants in the occupation the board regulates, the board can invoke state action immunity only if it is subject to active supervision by the state. Justice Kennedy for the majority stating, for example, the Sherman Act protects competition while also respecting federalism. It does not authorize the states to abandon markets to the unsupervised control of active market participants, whether trade associations or hybrid agencies. If a state wants to rely on active market participants as regulators, it must provide active supervision if state action immunity under Parker is to be invoked. The three dissenters, the dissent was written by Justice Alito, took kind of a well, it's always worked well before kind of approach. Staffing the State Board of Dental Examiners with certified public accountants would certainly lessen the risk of actions that place the well-being of dentists over the public, but this would also compromise the state's interest in sensibly regulating a technical profession in which lay people have little expertise, said Justice Alito. And the rest of the dissent sort of pokes sort of practical holes in the, or attempts to poke practical holes in the majority opinion. So, you know, what is a controlling number before this new doctrine comes into play? Is it a majority? Who is an active market participant? What is the scope of the market that is being defined for this analysis, and so on? So why did I pick this case? Well, I see this as one of those sort of dominoes cases. It's something that you can lead the students through, seeing if they can figure out which domino is going to fall next. So losing, or potentially losing, state antitrust immunity is the first domino. Then we start getting questions from consumer organizations and others as to exactly how are state boards around the country structured at the moment. Is this just a North Carolina issue, or is it broader? If that ends up with the composition of these boards changing, and changing quite markedly, then maybe we'll move away from guild favoring regulation that we sometimes suspect occurs to something that's more patient-centric. If that domino falls, then maybe we'll see more telemedicine. And if that domino falls, and it may well in Texas, because the Teladoc case there seemed very cognizant of the North Carolina case when the court allowed Teladoc the TRO. If that falls, then with more telemedicine, may we see some bending of the access and cost curves. I think also, and just to finish, I think it's a great case to illustrate the complexity and dynamic nature of health law. It reinforces the idea that health law is this giant umbrella for doctrine. Here we have antitrust law, licensure and discipline of healthcare professionals, and so on. And as for policy, we see this continual struggle to make markets work. We see the continuation here challenged of professional hegemony asserted through guilds, and all teachers can now put in their favorite quote from Paul Starr's book. And also, of course, we have agency capture. And finally, I guess there's sort of that push-pull between state and federal law and its agencies. And I guess a final reminder that we continually, as health lawyers, need to retool our skill sets. I don't know much about antitrust, but in this new world of the Affordable Care Act and restructuring like ACOs, consolidation amongst providers and insurers, I have a suspicion I'm going to have to learn a bit more, and so maybe should my students.
And next, we'll hear from Elizabeth Weeks Leonard, who teaches health law at the University of Georgia.
The new case that I would teach this fall and will teach is King versus Burwell. And it's new, but this is a little bit of a cheat because I actually taught it last fall. I taught King and Halbig. And it was when I introduced the cases last fall, it seems like this highly technical, really arcane sort of issue. But as the semester went on, of course, things developed and the students were really excited. And then cert was granted and they felt like they were on the cutting edge. And that was all very exciting. Well, now we come a year later and we have this opinion, which I think the question about whether to include King and where to include it in some ways is, of course, well, yes, because it's the big healthcare decision, the big Supreme Court decision from this term. But in some ways, no, because on the ground, I don't know that the case is that remarkable. In many ways, it simply affirms what I think most of us teaching in this area thought and believed, and now the Supreme Court agrees how we thought the statute was intended to operate and should operate. So in some ways, it's an opinion that maintains the status quo rather than really drastically changing how the Affordable Care Act implementation will look going forward. But I think it's important, and I think it's a good case pedagogically because it does lay out in good description the complexity of the private market piece of healthcare reform. What the court talks about is the three-legged stool, the different components of the reform to the private insurance market. So I think it's a good descriptor. As a matter, if I were teaching administrative law or statutory interpretation, I probably wouldn't want to teach it. I think it presents a lot of problems in that area, or at least I would be more cautious in how I approached it. But I think those points are maybe less important in the health law context than just the descriptive aspects of it.
And now it's a welcome back to Erin Fouzet-Brown, who's a professor of law at Georgia State College of Law.
It's great to be back. It's also great to be part of this back to school edition of TWIL. So I'm delighted to be here. So my selection for our back to school special is the very, very exciting development in the world of Stark Law. And this is the proposed rules changing the Stark Law regulations that came out on July 8th. From the agency of this summer. So these are some proposed changes to the Stark Law regulations. And these proposed rules, again, to emphasize to students, these are proposed rules. These are not, you know, final rules. So these aren't changes to the Stark Law, but these are what the agency is thinking of doing to change the Stark Law. And so therefore, it's one of those things that is sort of on the radar, but we don't know how it's all going to work out. The comment period is open until only September 8th. So unfortunately, we as health law professors, it's not going to be long enough for us to assign to our students the assignment of commenting on these proposed changes to the Stark Law. But hopefully, it is something that we can track throughout the semester and watch develop over the course of the next year. So the proposed rules, these proposed changes to the Stark Law came about as part of the release of the 2016 calendar year updates to the physician fee schedule. And so that was released earlier in July. And really, this proposed change to the Stark Law has three big components to it. The first one is that the proposals add some much needed flexibility to many of the areas that CMS has been seeing as areas of technical noncompliance. These are little ways you can trip up over the Stark Law requirements and trigger noncompliance and liability without even sort of realizing it. And so it proposes to address many of these areas, including missing signatures or whether you need a formal contract to have a writing. And you know, what happens if your term elapses and you don't realize it? Can you hold over the last agreement? And it adds a lot of flexibility to all of these types of technical noncompliance areas. So that's very important. Providers absolutely want this flexibility. The second thing that the proposed rules change is it proposes two new Stark Law exceptions that are designed primarily, it seems, to make it easier to meet increasing demand in, say, rural or underserved areas. So, for example, one of the exceptions would allow timeshare leases. So a traveling physician can come into a rural area and just step into an office for, you know, a day a week and not actually enter into a formal lease. The second new exception would be to allow hospitals to pay physicians to recruit non-physician providers like nurses or physician assistants to help them provide primary care, again, to increase access to primary care services. So those are two proposed new exceptions. And then finally, the agency asks, you know, stakeholders to comment broadly on what sorts of changes and exceptions are needed to the Stark Law and other fraud and abuse laws to accommodate this big push we're seeing toward value-based payment and the increasing integration and alignment that that calls for. And how can we do all of those alignments if we can't sort of form the relationships we need to because of things like the Stark Law or the anti-kickback statute? So that is the final sort of area that's just sort of, you know, what do we looking for comments from providers, from lawyers, from the general public as well. So as far as, you know, why should a health law student or even a health law professor care about something as arcane as a proposed change to the Stark Law, which is the bane of probably most health law students' existence? And the reason is that the Stark Law is extraordinarily important to health law practitioners. Health law attorneys absolutely spend a great deal of time thinking about the Stark Law, poring over the minutiae of the Stark Law, keeping abreast of all the developments in the Stark Law, because their clients absolutely care about it. And that nothing was highlighted so strongly as earlier, just a few days before this proposed rule came out, the Fourth Circuit reaffirmed the verdict, $237 million verdict against the Toomey Health System. And basically the judge who concurred, Judge Wynn, who concurred in the opinion, said Stark Law is a booby trap rigged with strict liability and potentially ruinous exposure for providers. And so that is pretty well summing up the feeling among providers, that this can be, you know, bet the company kind of non-compliance. You can trip it up by things like having, you know, your doctor didn't sign your contract. And these changes are a reaction to all of this criticism and came out of CMS's experience with the self-disclosure protocol, the voluntary self-disclosure protocol, where they're seeing a lot of these technical non-compliance self-disclosures rolling in where, you know, providers are saying, sorry, we messed up, but it was something that, you know, is as minimal as, you know, a missing signature or, you know, we have a bunch of invoices, but we don't have a written contract, but we obviously have a course of performance argument to make. So anyway, this is the drumbeat of criticism about the Stark Laws driving a lot of these changes. And then finally, I think as we move to more value-based payment methodologies, alternative payment systems, whether that's ACOs, whether it's the sort of the physicians moving toward more value-based payments, there is a concern that the Stark Law is actually working at odds with some of the goals of, you know, coordinating care, working together, sharing financial incentives, and that maybe the Stark Law was something that was more suited toward the fee-for-service era of medicine. And while it's not going away anytime soon, but maybe we want to see sort of more flexibility under the regime. So certainly something to keep track of. It's a way for health law students to show their chops to their potential future employers, and also a way to provide, you know, very valuable service to providers and other folks who are very interested in maintaining compliance with this onerous law.
This is Ross Silverman. I'm professor of health policy and management at the Indiana University Fairbanks School of Public Health, and I have a secondary appointment as professor of public health and law at the McKinney School of Law, also at Indiana University. The big issue in this year, as we go back to school in the world of public health law, I believe, is the passage of a new law in California known as Senate Bill 277, which is the first high-profile narrowing of a state's vaccination law in more than 35 years. What the law will do is remove vaccination exemptions on philosophical and personal belief grounds for many of the children in the California school systems. There are some exceptions, and I can talk a little bit about that. The way that it's structured is that a child entering into home and community daycares, nursery schools, public or private schools, but not homeschools, would have to demonstrate that they are fully up to date on their vaccinations in order to enter into those varying child-focused settings and education-focused settings. In the schools, these requirements kick in at certain thresholds. The entry into kindergarten or first grade, at seventh grade, or when a child enters into a new environment. So one of the unique wrinkles about this law is that it is not an annual redemonstration of having been vaccinated. If a child's already in the school system and is unvaccinated or is an exemptor, they really will not have to make a demonstration that they are up to date until they hit that next threshold. So essentially, this law is closing the door behind these children. The other components of this law that I think are really interesting is that they have included in the law ways for new vaccines to automatically be added if the state believes they are necessary. However, with new vaccines that are entered into the mandate, they will allow both a medical exemption and a personal belief exemption for those new vaccines. So what we're looking at here is a statement of belief and a statement of confidence in the already existent vaccines, but still allowing for a bit more of the science and the long-term studies on the safety of vaccines to play out. And if people have concerns about these new vaccines, they will be allowed to opt out of those. So one place I think is going to be a new threshold is going to be mandating flu vaccinations, which a few jurisdictions have started to do for daycares. In California, they will allow a personal belief exemption for those. A couple of pieces I think that are of interest in the discussion around this new law was the viciousness of the debate in the legislature. It was the law was Godwinned very early on during the proceedings by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., comparing the state action to Nazism. So there is still a good amount of discussion that can be had about the ethics and the policy side of this law. States constitutionally, there's a very strong argument to be made that they can pass these types of very restrictive laws. The question I think that can be raised in a class is, should they pass a law this restrictive? This is, I think, can be an open debate. Will many other states follow this? That's a question that remains open. Do the particulars of certain states' laws create unique legal challenges? So, for example, does a state have a constitutional guarantee of a right to education? Does this run in conflict with that right to education? Does a state have a RFRA law, a religious freedom law? Will that run in conflict with a law such as this? I think these are the kinds of things that you can really dig your teeth into in a class, and the kind of questions that I'm going to be raising in both my public health ethics class and my public health law class during the course of the year.
I'm Norm Tabler. I'm a lawyer with the law firm of Fagree Baker Daniels. I'm in the Indianapolis office, and my primary assignment is the healthcare team. I am the former general counsel and vice president of an Indiana hospital system called Indiana University Hospital System. And I'd like to talk to you about what I call the case the hospital lost for not violating the anti-kickback statute. And first, a reminder that the anti-kickback statute is the federal law prohibiting giving or receiving rewards for referring Medicare or Medicaid patients to a healthcare provider. The penalties are truly draconian. There's a hospital down in Jupiter, Florida called Jupiter Medical Center, and it had its own home health agency. Meanwhile, a bigger home agency system, Visiting Nurses Association, or VNA of Florida, decided to buy the home health agency from Jupiter. VNA's main interest was in getting preference from Jupiter's hospital discharge planners for those many patients who needed home health care after being discharged. So Jupiter promised VNA, as part of the transaction, that it would give it what amounted to preference among all home health agencies with its discharge planners. VNA paid $640,000 and, as part of the transaction, agreed to take over Jupiter's rent obligation in an off-campus office building. Well, at some point, Jupiter decided, correctly as it happens, that the arrangement violated the anti-kickback statute because it, Jupiter, had been rewarded for giving VNA preference among home health agencies. So Jupiter stopped giving VNA any preference. In response to that, VNA stopped paying rent for the office space in that off-campus office building. Jupiter sued VNA over the rent issue. VNA invoked the arbitration provision that was part of the overall transactional contract. And the arbitrator heard the matter and sided with VNA, ordering Jupiter to pay $2.5 million. And you'll remember that Jupiter had received only $640,000 in the first place. Jupiter went to court trying to overturn the order on the grounds that the arbitrator was ordering it, in effect, to violate the anti-kickback statute, something, by the way, that Jupiter had not argued during the arbitration. case got to the Florida Supreme Court, and the Florida Supreme Court refused to intervene or overturn the order, even though the contract was illegal. Its reasoning was this. The Federal Arbitration Act has only five exceptions to the general prohibition on judicial intervention, and Jupiter's illegality argument isn't one of those five. And then on May 4 of this year, the United States Supreme Court denied Jupiter's petition for certiorari, so the Florida Supreme Court case stands. So what are the lessons from this case? I think there are probably three main lessons. First, whenever Medicare or Medicaid patients are involved in any way, arbitration can be very dangerous. Arbitration provisions almost never permit appeals, and as you see from this case, courts won't intervene in the matter. Second, Jupiter, if it did go to arbitration, should have raised that illegality anti-kickback statute during the arbitration rather than waiting until after the order was entered. Third, and this applies not just to healthcare lawyers but to lawyers in general, the fact is that filing a lawsuit is very dangerous. Don't forget, in this case, it was Jupiter who went to court. Jupiter filed the lawsuit in the first place. The case is Visiting Nurses Association of Florida versus Jupiter Medical Center.
Hi, my name is Brietta Clark, and I'm a professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. This pitch is to health law professors who cover healthcare quality. My recommendation would be to incorporate a recent case involving the state regulation of licensed mental health professionals, specifically a ban on sexual orientation change efforts performed on minors. Sexual orientation change efforts, or SOCH for short, is probably better known by other labels like gay conversion therapy or gay reparative therapy, but I'll use the term SOCH. The main case I have in mind is Pickup v. Brown, a Ninth Circuit decision from last year which upheld a California SOCH ban. There's also a Third Circuit case which upheld a similar ban in New Jersey. Both were appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the court denied cert. I covered the Pickup case and the issue of SOCH regulation last year in my health law survey, and it turned out to be a wonderful way to explore the role of law and ethics in regulating healthcare professionals. First, it provided a great opportunity for students to grasp how difficult it can be to assess healthcare quality. I find it hard to give students adequate grounding in the science of a particular practice so that they can think critically about the challenges lawmakers face in deciding whether and how to regulate that practice. But in the case of SOCH, the American Psychological Association, or the APA, produced a terrific report on the appropriate therapeutic responses to sexual orientation. It's a great teaching tool to use in conjunction with the Pickup case. It tries to evaluate claims about SOCH's efficacy, benefits, and harm, but explains the difficulty of doing this in light of flaws in the design and methodology of SOCH research. The report uses clear and compelling examples of the various flaws and presents sophisticated scientific and methodological concepts in an easily digestible form. This yielded a much richer discussion of whether to regulate SOCH and how. SOCH cases also require students to consider the factors that can guide lawmakers making regulatory decisions in the face of scientific uncertainty. I'll just mention three. The first is constitutional protections. In Pickup and King, SOCH providers challenged the bans on free speech and religious freedom grounds, and parents desiring SOCH for their children insisted the ban infringed a fundamental right to make medical decisions for their children. As a result, they argue the state must prove that a practice is harmful before instituting a ban, while the state insisted this was too high a burden and would undermine its power to protect the health and welfare. Although the state won in both cases, these arguments are still very much alive among lawmakers in other states who are debating whether to enact similar bans. Also, health law scholars are increasingly preoccupied with free speech claims being used to resist government regulation. So the Pickup case provides a valuable taxonomy of how to think about speech claims in the healthcare context that could have implications beyond SOCH. The second factor students get to consider is ethics. So the students consider how the ethical principles of autonomy, non-maleficence, and justice may have informed lawmakers' decisions to ban SOCH on children. They highlight the vulnerability of children, the importance of self-identity to emotional well-being, and the history of discrimination against gays and lesbians as relevant ethical considerations. The third factor they consider is the relationship between law and culture. Developments in the science of sex have been heavily influenced by changing cultural and social norms, and this is certainly true for SOCH regulation. Students seemed thirsty for the opportunity to discuss this intersection of law, culture, politics, and medicine. Finally, I just want to mention two other benefits I think social coverage brings. One, it provides a nice avenue for contrasting different forms of healthcare regulation. For example, concerns that social providers may be providing misleading information about its efficacy has led to proposals for specific informed consent requirements and at least one successful consumer fraud suit filed against a social provider in New Jersey. Also, the problem of relying solely on medical malpractice to police quality is even more acute in the area of mental health care, where the harm suffered is predominantly or exclusively emotional in nature. Finally, mental health care quality deserves greater attention in the health law curriculum, and SOCIA is a great tool for doing this. In addition to the issues mentioned above, it implicates the question of the unlicensed practice of psychology, which is something we don't hear much about. The APA report revealed that SOCIA is performed by laypersons often, by religious leaders, for example. And I challenged my students to explain how this could be. They combed the California psychology licensing laws and were surprised by what they found. And they really seemed to enjoy wrestling with these various statutory provisions, something else that it can be hard to get students to do. Bottom line, one of my most enriching classroom experiences has been through discussion of SOCH.
And now welcome back to Glenn Cohen, professor of law at Harvard Law School and the faculty director of the Petri Flom Center for Health Law Policy, Biotechnology, and Bioethics. Welcome back to TWIL, Glenn.
Thanks for having me again. Reproductive technologies, I think most people think of them as on the cutting edge, and in fact they are, but for the most part, it's been a relatively stable set of legal questions and technologies until, I would say, the last year. We've had a really big shakeup in this respect, a suite of technologies, and I'm just going to talk briefly about three of them. The first is egg freezing technology, so the ability for women who are in particular planning to reproduce later in life to freeze their eggs. The second is mitochondrial replacement therapy, which the FDA is currently considering and Parliament in the UK has tentatively approved. And the last one is CRISPR-Cas9 technology for genome editing. And each of them raises new and interesting ethical issues that will be of interest to bioethics and the law students. Egg freezing is in some ways the most tangible in the way it fits into what we currently do. Through egg freezing, women now have multiple options in terms of how they manage their fertility. It raises a series of issues outside of health law, like employment discrimination, with the news that several media companies began offering egg freezing as a benefit they cover. Could a law firm or a tech company have a promotion practice that discriminates against women who choose to have children while on the mommy track instead of delaying their reproduction? But it also raises some issues quite germane to health law and bioethics itself. One is a question of insurance coverage. Should insurers cover this? Should mandates that cover reproductive technology cover it? A second has to do with the creation of a market in frozen eggs, similar to the market in sperm. So what will happen when you can go to a bank and select from 10,000 egg donors the way you can, maybe not that high a number, but a large number of sperm donors at the moment. And then a third is the relationship of this technology to a set of cases many of us teach on pre-embryo disposition, where people freeze embryos and when they're married, get divorced, and have a fight over them, whether these technologies of egg freezing will both be an alternative to getting yourself in this mess, but something courts will look at and say, why didn't you freeze your eggs? You had a way out here. You didn't need the embryos had you taken this step. So I'm very interested to see what happens there. Much more briefly, the other two technologies. Genome editing, this is very exciting. Currently, again, we're deciding whether we're going to allow it to go forward at all with the human genome. But the big thing here is this would be one of the first germline, as opposed to somatic cell alterations in the human genome. So whatever changes we made, whether to deal with diseases, which will be the first step, or possibly future human enhancements, will be passed on maybe indefinitely into the human genome and future generations. And this has raised a lot of questions whether the line between germline and somatic cell alterations is a kind of red line we shouldn't cross. And in fact, Congress has recently, through an appropriations bill, indicated that it will not allow FDA to review or will not fund the review of any technology that involves germline alterations. The last is mitochondrial replacement therapy, and this has really been a challenge to FDA and the way FDA reviews things. So this is a technology that allows you to essentially, in lay terms, replace the battery pack of a cell for people who have mitochondrial disease. And the big issues being raised here, so in the UK there was a vociferous debate, is it safe? Is FDA the right agency to review this? The federal government, Congress, has tried to indicate that it wants faith-based people involved in the review. The whole matter has been given to the IOM, but it's a very interesting case study in the politics of reproductive technology and also the politics of FDA. It may also in the future raise interesting issues about parentage claims by the mitochondrial donor. So it's often referred to as three-parent embryos because there's a third person involved as the donor of the mitochondrial genetic information. And maybe in the future we'll see questions about parentage, questions about inheritance from the mitochondrial donor, although I think at least in the short term, those are unlikely.
Next, we're joined by Professor Micah Berman, who holds a joint appointment with the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law and the College of Public Health.
In health law, it's easy to forget that most things that influence health happen outside of the healthcare system. So one thing that I'm thinking about incorporating into my health law class a little bit better this year is things like the social determinants of health and the influence of poverty on health. Things that have a huge influence on health and healthcare, but aren't necessarily part of the normal legal doctrine that's reviewed in health law cases. But I think it's really important to talk about these issues. Really, the largest determinant of a child's health is his or her parents' income, and we see huge disparities by race as well in the U.S. So I think it's important to take some time in health law classes to think about who's showing up for care, what they're showing up for, and why they're showing up, how disease is distributed in the community. And that naturally leads into a discussion of poverty and social determinants like unemployment, educational opportunity, housing, and how those things get translated into health outcomes. So I think this is particularly relevant as health systems are being asked to take on a broader role in population health, and health systems and their attorneys need to be familiarizing themselves with these issues and thinking about all healthcare and health law issues in that context. So in terms of incorporating that into my class, I think there are a lot of different possibilities. One thing is that a lot of communities now have medical legal partnerships, and so having speakers come in for medical legal partnerships and speak about that is one easy way to integrate that into the class. There are lots of different organizations around the country that do poverty simulations that allow students to think about the choices that need to be made for people who are living in poverty and how that might influence health. This could be a great topic for a facilitated conversation between law students and medical students, or law students and health administration students. And then there are also some good resources out there, like the PBS series on natural causes. I've used that in my class before as a way to get people talking about some of these issues and how they are reflected or not reflected in the law. And then there's also a book out there. I think the title is Poverty, Health, and the Law, that is edited by Elizabeth Tobin Tyler and others, that has some great readings and materials that can be used in health law classes as well. So as I said, this is not a traditional issue covered in health law classes, but I think it's a really important one to think about including.
This is Nicole Huberfeld, the Ashland Spears Distinguished Research Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky College of Law and Bioethics Associate at the College of Medicine. And I am glad to be here to talk about the big case that I think is important to cover in upcoming healthcare law classes this semester, especially a healthcare organizations and finance or healthcare finance kind of class. So it's probably no surprise that I'm focused on Armstrong versus Exceptional Child Center, a decision that the Supreme Court issued in late March of this last term. And I don't want to talk about the substance of the case so much as I want to talk about why I think it hits different high notes in terms of teaching healthcare law in particular. So Armstrong is the decision in which the Supreme Court held that healthcare providers who were participating in Medicaid could no longer seek fair payment in federal court. Instead, the court decided in a decision authored by Justice Scalia that it's HHS's job to negotiate the idea of fair payment or equal access, fair payment through equal access with the states directly. And so the way that Justice Scalia wrote the opinion sort of indicates that the healthcare providers should never have had this ability in the first place and that Congress never intended this for to be the way that Medicaid worked. And so I actually think that Armstrong provides an opportunity to think about the way that healthcare cases get decided. I think there's a really intriguing aspect to this case that highlights what I think of as sort of the circle of impossibility surrounding Medicaid, because there are so many competing interests for this program that covers 71 million people now, 22% of the population. And so I know a lot of people shy away from Medicaid and teaching healthcare law, but it covers almost a quarter of the population, and I think that we can't ignore it anymore. And it offers this sort of fascinating parfait of issues, because in this circle of impossibility, you've got federal courts, you've got the federal executive, you've got HHS, separate from the executive, which you really see in Armstrong and in its predecessor case, Douglas versus Independent Living Center, which was decided just 3 years ago. You've got enrollees and providers sort of working together to try to figure out what equal access to care means. And then you've also got the states, and the states themselves are not monolithic. Sometimes the executive branch and the legislature are working at odds in the Medicaid program in the states. And so Armstrong really allows you to bring all of this forward. And there are a number of primary sources that I think tell this really fascinating story about the different interests in Medicaid and how some of these interests are working at odds and some of them are working together. I would like to use not only Armstrong itself, which is, by the way, not a long opinion. It's got an interesting concurrence by Justice Breyer and a terrific dissent by Justice Sotomayor, but still not a long opinion at all. You could actually assign the whole thing. But I would also suggest assigning the brief of former HHS administrators, the amicus brief written by Steve Vladeck, whose father, Bruce Vladeck, of course, was an important administrator for HHS. It's a terrific brief about the struggles that HHS faces in administering Medicaid because it is both understaffed and underfunded, and really drives home the point that HHS was relying on these private rights of action and the role that providers play in being sort of on-the-ground watchdogs for the agency. I would also assign 30A itself. It's a short statutory provision, you know, just to get the sort of the statutory point to the students. I would also assign the draft regulation 430A that was issued in 2011 and that has never been finalized as a point that we can drive home about regulatory failure or regulatory stagnation. I think in some ways it underlines the point being made in the amicus brief, where HHS says that it's basically overworked and can't manage Medicaid in the way that the court imagines that it can. I think you see that in what's happening with this stagnant draft regulation. And following up on that, in the wake of Armstrong, some members of Congress sent a letter to HHS saying, hey, you've got to finish this regulation. And the regulation itself in draft form is actually also pretty digestible. It's not one of the longer episodes that we get in the Federal Register. And so if you take this constellation of documents, you get this really interesting picture of the sort of power struggles that are happening in Medicaid, the importance of Medicaid, the confusion surrounding it. And I think it tells this really interesting tale in the larger healthcare law picture about the sort of layers that we deal with in the day-to-day, both on a theoretical and a very practical sort of grassroots level. So that's what I would like to tackle this semester.
So my topic that I'd like to focus on is the rise of narrow networks among exchange-based health insurance plans under the Affordable Care Act. And just to give a little bit of background here, we all know that under the Affordable Care Act, there are plans on the exchanges. Thanks to restrictions that have been put into the Affordable Care Act, some traditional modes of insurers trying to maximize profits by, for example, cherry picking the healthy and lemon dropping the sick. Those have been regulatorily, statutorily prohibited. So they've had to go towards other strategies in order to increase profits, of course, mindful of the medical loss ratio. And one of the strategies that has been very popular has been the rise of these narrow networks. And a narrow network is simply insurers deciding that they're going to cover only one segment of physicians, not covering, say, wider swathes of physicians. And it has even given rise to even more specialized nomenclature. For example, the McKinsey Institute has put out a report on very narrow networks that I believe cover less than 25% of providers within a given area. Then there are narrow networks, which I think is under 50%. Maybe it's less than that. And then there are sort of normal networks. And these narrow networks have really given rise to some difficult health issues, and I think they will lead to a revival of interest in cases about HMOs and soon HMOs for liability that are in some of our health law casebooks. For example, you know, you have situations where you might have someone that goes in to get a surgery or, say, a gastrointestinal procedure at a hospital, and they may very diligently find a gastroenterologist who is a covered network provider for their plan, but then find out that anesthesiologists and pathologists are not covered. Okay? And this can lead to huge unexpected medical bills that people were really not aware of being possible. Well, in many places, these medical bills do cause considerable consternation and angst for the patient. But as of April 1st this year, New York State has put forward a new law that is trying to protect patients from unexpected out-of-network bills. So as of April 1st this year, the patients don't have to pay for these charges immediately. Instead, what goes on is that the state says that the insurer and the out-of-network providers have to engage in a mediation first. And then there's this sort of dispute settlement procedure that's going to go on. And this sort of independent dispute resolution process, I think, is going to be a significant consumer protection for lots of individuals. You're also seeing in some states, I believe South Dakota is one of them, the rise of any willing provider laws that are trying to reduce, say, the leverage of these insurers to create these narrow or very narrow networks by requiring them to take any willing provider onto the network. So I think that this ongoing struggle will be interesting. I think another just fascinating case study will be how far can someone be forced to travel? Like, for example, if the network, the narrow network that's established, if that's going to have your gastroenterologist is going to be 20, 30, 50, 100 miles away, is that too far? Is that an adequate network? How many have to be on staff? How long a wait before people can reasonably complain to insurance commissioners and others that they are having to wait too long for care? All of these, I think, are really fascinating, difficult, substantive issues of insurance regulation that are all going to be implicated by the rise of the narrow networks.
And this was this week's rather special The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to all of our colleagues and friends who joined us for this episode. It was a lot of time they spent, and we really appreciate it.
Finally, as always, our show notes are at twihl.com.
You can contact me at Nicholas Terry. That's Nicholas Terry on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be found?
I'm at Frank Pasquale on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.